Welcome back to the FICCast. This is episode number 333. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have back on the show. I'm going to pronounce your name correctly this time, Sue Falsoni. Sue, how you doing?
I'm great, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Like we recorded an agenda-free little segment for the Patreon supporters before now, but it's like the snow's almost gone in New England. The page is turning. Spring is almost here. So that is nothing but, you know, good on my end. And you're in Arizona, of course, which is always beautiful, right?
It is. This is the perfect time of year. We've got maybe 3 or 4 weeks left before the heat really starts to sit in. So I'm enjoying being at my house right now.
Well, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. The audience really stepped it up when it came to questions for you. I know some of these are like follow-ups from the last time that you're on, which thinking back was maybe like 6 or 8 months ago. Who knows? I don't even know these days when we're recording so many of these. But we got some great feedback, and it's great to have you back on. The first thing that I want to mention real quick is that I saw Laree Draper just posted a picture of a shoulder DVD of a lecture that you did or a seminar that you put together. What's up with that? Like, I literally just saw the news about it today, and I'm guessing we're expecting that in a couple weeks.
Yes, I am so fired up. It's my first, product really, my first DVD that I'll have out there. And, you know, how fitting that it's on the shoulder considering how much time I've spent in that area over the last several years. I did some filming with Laree's film crew back in October, and we recorded, I think what will end up being maybe 3 DVDs or so. So this is going to be the first one that's coming out, and I'm really fired up about it. We don't have an exact date, but it's off to the replicator, so it should be about 3 weeks, and I'm really excited to put it out there and see how people respond and get some good feedback and kind of move into that space, which is obviously a little bit new for me.
I'm rather disappointed. First time you ever came out to MBSC, you said that your favorite muscle was the diaphragm. So having it not be the diaphragm, I mean, is a little bit of a letdown, but maybe that's going to be coming up down the road.
It will definitely come up down the road for sure.
So going off of that, you're talking a lot now, not talking, but you're doing seminars, you're doing lectures all over the place now. You're traveling around the world. You're doing the Perform Better Summits this year again, coming off of last year. What's that been like? Because you're coming off of working at what is now called Exos, but Athletes Performance, and then you went to the Los Angeles Dodgers, where you had a little bit of a home base. I guess you're doing some traveling with the team, obviously, but now you're really going all over the place. So has that been like a hard transition to go from kind of being in one spot to now, like, you know, every other weekend, every couple weekends, you're going to be traveling?
Yeah, it's definitely been a transition. I think, in general, 2014, kind of October 2013 to October of 2014 was sort of, a sabbatical year for me, so to speak. And, you know, I definitely worked, but kind of took my time and just sort of regenerated and recouped after, you know, the last, I don't know, lifetime, I guess, of really working multiple jobs and multiple things really since I was 16 years old. So, that year was kind of a great regen year. And then things kind of have slowly, well, not slowly ramped up. They basically went from 0 to 60 in a matter of a month. So, really since October, you know, over the last 6 months, it's been quite a whirlwind, you know, and it's a huge blessing. I mean, to have, you know, work, and to have people want you to be present at their seminars, or, you know, to have people come teach, you know, time is so valuable. And I recognize that a lot now. So for people to travel or give up their weekends to spend it with you, you know, that's a really powerful thing. And so I've really enjoyed it. I enjoy meeting people all over the country and all over the world and, you know, comparing notes. And it sounds super cliche, but, you know, when I enjoy teaching because I learn so much when I teach, it sounds super cliche, but it's really true. But, it's been good. It's, you know, I do wish I was home a little bit more, but I think that clearly I enjoy my life like this because I continue to seek opportunities that make it just a little bit crazy.
Well, on top of all that, I guess it was a couple months back now, but you announced that you're now head of athletic training and sports performance with the U.S. Men's soccer team. So you've even added that on top of everything else. So tell me a little bit about that. And obviously you're transitioning now from working, you know, when you were with the Dodgers, working with sport of baseball, now you're transitioning to, I mean, it's all shoulders over there. And now it's kind of all like hips and knees and ankles.
Yeah.
You know, soccer guys.
Yeah. It's totally different. You know, I had worked with Jurgen Klinsmann, the head coach, back in 2011 and, you know, had a good experience. And then I took the head job with the Dodgers, obviously. So sort of disappeared from soccer for a couple years there. And then, you know, Jurgen had called me in October and they had an opening and he asked me to take this position. And so, you know, so I thought long and hard about it and decided I would do it. And, I've really enjoyed it. You know, I have not worked in the soccer space very much. So I am learning a ton, which is really exciting and really great. You know, at the end of the day, movement is movement, you know, and I feel comfortable with that. But it's fun to just learn everything about a new sport, right? Whether it's the sport itself or the technical and tactical things or the culture of that sport. And then, you know, related more to my industry, yeah, it's a completely different set of injuries. You know, we're looking at consistently hamstring, adductors, strains, you know, sports hernia type stuff, ab strains, you know, hip impingement, torn up knees, you know, ACL tears, MCL sprains, you know, tons of ankle sprains. So it really just has completely shifted some of the things that I typically have focused on in the past, you know, in the upper quarter with the baseball guys, you know, now it's a bit more of a lower quarter focus with the soccer guys. So it's been a fun transition for my career for sure.
Well, I guess, like I said, you're kind of focusing, you know, primarily on the shoulder with baseball players. That's where they're going to run into a lot of issues. But is it mostly, like you said, is it mostly hamstrings or, you know, with the soccer players, just like, is that mostly, like what I'm trying to say is, like NBSC, when we see our soccer players, our field hockey players, it's like almost half the time it's going to be hamstrings just because they just don't know how to slow themselves down. They'll always get hurt trying to slow down or change direction. Is that what you're seeing also at the elite level with the men's team?
Yeah. You know, for us, I've seen a lot of groin issues and definitely some hamstring issues. It just sort of seems like it's that entire pelvic, you know, pelvic bowl. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one big puzzle piece that is just really sort of difficult to figure out. I mean, you know, you've got the groin and the hamstring insertions are also close together. And, you know, it is unbelievable how much they lack hip extension, you know, and just hip mobility in general. I'm amazed by it. And so, you know, I think that's where a lot of the hamstring stuff comes into play too. Cause if you lack hip extension, you know, then obviously you can't utilize glute function very well. And so your lumbar paraspinals and your hamstrings have to work harder and they have to work in a fashion that they necessarily weren't meant to work in. And so, you know, just kind of exploring all sort of that lumbopelvic hip dysfunction, in a little bit different fashion. Then obviously with the upper quarter stuff, a lot of that pain, stems from lower quarter dysfunction. So it's not like the lower quarter was completely ignored before, but, you know, I'm just looking at it in a different way. And we see all those things, which is different. I'm learning quite a bit about the management of it, you know, and how do you, those guys, you know, they're running, gosh, I don't know, 7 miles, you know, give or take a game. I mean, it's out of control. So how to return those guys, and they're sprinting. That's a thing, you know, that I've learned a lot too. It's, they're just not kind of jogging around that field. I mean, they are sprinting for 90 minutes and, you know, to return them to play in a safe and efficient, ethical manner has been a really fun thing for me to learn. And hopefully I'll continue to get better at it.
I'm curious because with baseball players, like specifically pitchers, you know, I've heard whether it be from, you know, Mike or from you or from like people like Eric Cresti saying, you know, with pitchers specifically, you know, they may have shoulder tightness that you don't want to really mess with because that's like specific to their mechanics. Have you found that You were mentioning just people on the men's, not just like the men's soccer team, but just in general, having issues with their hip mobility. Is that something that you feel like you don't want to mess with too much, because maybe that lack of hip mobility is something that got them to where they are today, whether it be for speed or whatever, like at that elite level, is that something that you need to worry about?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that that is something that I have learned probably the hard way. You know, in-season type stuff and off-season type stuff are two completely different animals. And when you have an athlete who is in the off-season, you know, that's when you've got time to make your changes. When you're in the middle of a competition, I think you're walking a really fine line when you start to make large biomechanical changes, whether it's in their range of motion or those sorts of things, because their bodies just don't necessarily have time to adapt to that new range of motion that you've given them. And so, yeah, I think it's definitely a concern, a clinical concern that, you know, that's sort of where the art of what we do comes into play. Right. We definitely have to have those considerations when we're working with the athletes, and when we know they have a competition coming up in a few days, and kind of walk that tightrope, you know, just a little bit. But yeah, I completely agree. I think it's definitely something that I consider and keep in the back of my mind as we're trying to make some changes.
All right. I selfishly took the first 10 minutes of the episode for myself. I'm going to give the rest to the audience. So, all right, we got a lot of questions about, dry needling. So I want to first start off, just in case people didn't listen to that previous episode, I'm coming in. I have no idea what it is. What is it? Who is it for in terms of getting it done on? And then also, who is it for, like, in the fitness industry? Who should be, you know, considering this as, like, you know, maybe, obviously, I should have prefaced this by saying that you actually do a lot of seminars and a lot of workshops for dry needling that people can check out. But right. Also in the profession, like, is this something as me as a strength coach, you know, should I be looking into this as, you know, potential practice?
Yeah. You know, you have to be an allied healthcare practitioner in order to practice dry needling, and it varies from state to state. So athletic trainers, physical therapists, chiropractors, physicians, nurses, those types of professions are typically eligible to take those classes. But as I said, it's very, very different from profession to profession and from state to state. So an allied healthcare professional really needs to check their state practice acts to see if it's something that they're able to do. If it is something they're able to do, it is a practice changing technique that, you know, I'm fired up to be able to teach in conjunction with Dr. Ma. You know, my courses are called systemic dry needling, and Dr. Ma and I created a course specifically for orthopedic issues and sports injuries, and how I utilize that stuff, you know, with the athletes and with my patients. And so it has just been an unbelievably powerful technique. And if you can't perform it right as a strength coach or a personal trainer, mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you can't educate yourself about it, mm-hmm. because, you know, strength coaches and personal trainers know better than I do. They're dealing with, you know, how often do you actually have a client comes in that isn't dealing with pain, you know, or is, you know, feeling perfect, that you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And so, you know, to be able to collaborate with clinicians who are on the cutting edge of different treatment techniques, and the dry needling is definitely a practice changing technique that, you know, if it's in your state practice act and you're able to do it, I highly recommend you doing it. It's completely changed how I function.
So again, I'm a complete idiot. So break this down for me. What exactly is going on physically while you're doing this to the patient?
Yeah. So, you know, dry needling, we use a fine filament needle, you know, and most people will, you know, they can kind of relate it to acupuncture, you know, similar needle, potentially a similar manual technique, but it's not. Acupuncture and dry needling are quite frankly totally different. You know, just because you use a calculator doesn't mean you're an accountant. And just because you use a fine filament needle doesn't mean you're an acupuncturist. And so the difference with dry needling is really it's based on a Western medicine philosophy. You know, it's not rooted in Eastern medicine at all. It's rooted in Western medicine. And so, you know, the actual physical act is, you know, we are inserting needles into dry needles into certain parts of the body, whether it be, you know, muscle, ligament, tendon, you know, those sorts of things, trigger points, whatever it may be, to really help biomechanical issues, neurobiomechanical issues within the body. And so there's so many things on a systemic level that happen, you know, locally, segmentally within the spinal cord, as well as systemically with neurotransmitters that get released from our brain. So it's a fantastic anti-inflammatory and anti-nociceptive technique that really can help with pain and inflammation without having to, you know, I mean, so many of my athletes spent their lives on Tylenol and anti-inflammatory medication and NSAIDs, you know, and we're testing liver functions and kidney functions, you know, with blood work to make sure that everything's functioning fine. And, you know, so if we can offer a non-medication way to help control inflammation and pain from a therapeutic standpoint, for me, I think that's huge.
And for people, just a quick heads up, if you're driving, I will throw this in the show notes, but you can also go to suefalsone.com and click on the SDN tab on the far right-hand side. You can go there, and then you can also get information on it and also information on Dr. Ma's courses as well that Sue is putting on. That's awesome. All right, so baseball season just started yesterday. I guess technically it was like 2 days. It was Sunday night, but are you excited for baseball this year now that you've kind of been out of it for a little bit? Are you still, I know people are always a little bit more connected with the sport when you're there every single day. Are you turning on the TV, like the MLB Network, and checking out some baseball? Or,
you know, it's funny. I did not watch one game yesterday or Sunday night. I did check the scores at the end of the day. I checked to see if the Dodgers had won, which they did, which was great. So yeah, I mean, other than checking, you know, kind of checking the scores and checking to make sure that the guys I've worked with in the past are healthy. Mm-hmm. That's about where I'm at.
Fair enough.
So not too many games. I didn't go to one spring training game. I'm definitely excited for it. It's definitely different year two now. This is my second season being removed. Mm-hmm. And I definitely was less melancholy yesterday than I was a year ago. A year ago, I was watching opening day and, you know, I was missing it a little bit. Whereas yesterday I had a day off. So, you know, I was drinking some cocktails with a friend by the pool. So I was not missing opening day.
Yeah, it sounds like you're doing all right. You're enjoying the day still.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I said, it's about 45 degrees. It's a beautiful, beautiful weather here in Massachusetts. And this is warm for us. And it is April 7th. And it's still, it's garbage here. Another thing that I've been talking about in a couple of these past like dozen or so episodes with professionals in the industry is how, you know, their approach to yoga has either changed or how they are implementing, you know, things that they've learned in the practice of yoga with strength and conditioning or just with people in general. And you are certified as a yoga instructor. So especially coming from your end, I'm really interested to see, like, you know, What do you think about yoga at this point? Of course, I have the reference of Mike Boyle, who like 2 years ago was just yelling about yoga all the time. But now that, you know, we've gotten a look at, you know, the breathing and the PRI stuff, and he's like, oh, okay, all right, maybe it wasn't all, you know, BS. Maybe there was something there. So I'm curious to see kind of where you're at and how you implement that into your practice.
Oh, that is so funny. Yeah, I technically am 7 hours, observational hours away from my certification. I've got 7 yoga classes to observe, and then I will officially be done. But cool. All of my scholastic and practical stuff is done. So, you know, it was just one of those things that I wanted to do kind of in that sabbatical part of my year. You know, I did the 200-hour certification through a yoga studio near here, near where I the studio I practice at, and actually where I filmed the shoulder DVD. So that's my yoga studio. So that's what I'm talking about this year at Perform Better. I talked about it at the Austin One Day, and I'll be talking about it in Long Beach.
Oh, awesome.
So,
man, I almost like don't even want you to spoil it.
I won't give too much away, but I'll get people fired up for it.
All right.
And the biggest thing is I think I've at least convinced Michael to say the phrase, "I don't think yoga is stupid." And if I can have done that, then I did my job.
it might sound like me blowing smoke, but it's tough. Like I go to every single Perform Better Summit every single year. So I'm going to all three of them. I go to at least one of the one days, and you see a lot of topics throughout the weekend. There's lots of presenters, lots of outstanding presenters, but you know, after, it sounds like I've been in the industry for a long time, but you know, I'm 29 now. I've been doing stuff, you know, going to these seminars since I was 19. Last year you had a super fascinating talk, and this year I'm excited to hear you talk about yoga, because a lot of times it's like, man, I mean, do I need to really go to another lecture on speed training?
Right.
Maybe not. But see, that's why I'm like, maybe I don't even want you to talk about this, because I just want to, I'm going to be there out in Long Beach, and maybe I just want to check it out. But,
well, the premise of the talk is just how much we already utilize yoga within our current, movement training and weight room training type stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that, the whole reason I even wanted to do the topic was I was at Perform Better Summit last year, and, you know, watching people go through different exercises and calling it whatever name. And it doesn't matter what name you call an exercise, but, you know, I'm kind of watching a lab, and I'm like, oh, well, that's downward dog. And, oh, well, that's wild thing. And, oh, that's a crescent pose. And, you know, and it just kind of got me thinking, like, you know, to kind of go back and sort of honor the root sometimes of where we come from, mm-hmm. Is important to me. And to kind of, you know, look back and, you know, not just read the interpretation of what someone is saying, but to go back and find that article and read the whole article and have your own interpretation. You know, so many times we pass down this folklore, you know, it's like the telephone game, you know, one study, you know, of, about transverse ab from Australia 15 years ago gets extrapolated into something that it necessarily never was. And so, you know, to kind of go back to the root of where a lot of our movement-based efforts come from, was important to me. And so, you know, hopefully I can kind of shed some light that yoga is not necessarily, about just relaxation and stretching, and that there's a lot more to it than that. And hopefully, you know, my goal is to have people leave saying, okay, I don't hate yoga.
Well, do you know what day you're presenting in Long Beach?
I am presenting, you know what? That's a great question. I don't know.
I'll look it up real quick as we go into the next question. Then I'll throw it in as we talk, because I think Mike is only going to be there on Friday. So hopefully he's going to sit in and check that out. But, and also the great thing about the summits is that it's like an hour and 15 lecture, then an hour 15 hands-on too. So you get to not only check out the lecture, but then you also get to, do some stuff. So these are, you never talk about these Perform Better summits enough. And, you're going to be in Long Beach. Are you just going to Long Beach this year?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'll just be in Long Beach. I know the summer is, we have, with the men's team, we have Gold Cup this summer. Mm-hmm. So, and we're also playing Germany and Amsterdam and friendlies in June. So June and July are pretty much U.S. soccer.
I got good news. Sue's going to be speaking on Friday. So
yay!
Mike will be there, because Mike is going to be speaking Friday afternoon.
Perfect.
It is perfect, and it'll be cool to get his thoughts afterwards as well. Awesome. All right, so I lied. All right, I took 24 minutes of the start of the show for myself. Now we're going to get into the questions from the audience. So Paul has a question. So he says, I'm interested in questions about what Sue's approach is in aquatic training. I'm thinking this goes beyond swimming and fluid running, but in what ways? Any specific injuries that aquatic therapy is really good for? What about the performance application for AT? Keep up the great work.
Oh, Great. Thank you. Yeah, you know, if I have water available, I utilize water all the time, whether it's from a rehabilitative state or from a performance state. I utilize the water all the time. And he's absolutely correct in the fact that it's not just about swimming or sort of jogging in the deep end. There's so much more to it. I used to speak for an aquatic therapy company, and it really is amazing how much people don't sort of realize the application that water has with our sport and athletic population. You know, so many of the drills that we're all used to doing on land, such as, you know, whether they're wall drills, you know, our speed training drills or movement preparation, or even introducing plyometrics, you know, the water does a few different things for us. First of all, you know, the viscosity of water kind of allows us to control the resistance. And so if we move really slow during water, in the water can help assist our range of motion. If we move really fast in the water, it can really resist our range of motion. So we can utilize the water to either assist or resist our range based on, you know, if we're going parallel to the water surface, if we're going against it, and how fast we're moving. So that's huge from a rehabilitative state as people are starting to increase the speed of their movement, which can typically be scary. You know, and especially from a plyometric standpoint, you know, where do people typically get hurt? They don't get hurt jumping up, they get hurt landing. Mm-hmm. And so to allow the water to slow down the landing process to really teach landing mechanics has been absolutely huge for me. And then the other thing too is you can play with water depth, you know. So if you're at the level of the umbilicus, then, you know, you're taking about 50% weight off of that person. You know, if you're at the nipple level, you're taking about, I think it's 75%-ish, maybe 80%-ish weight off of them. You know, and if it's their head above the water, you've got about 90% of their weight off of them. So, you know, when we start talking about 350-pound linemen, or, you know, I had a football player last year that I worked with, you know, he's 300 pounds. So, you know, to be able to decrease the load on his joint, you know, from anywhere from 50% to 80%, whether it is every day from a rehabilitative state, or if it's just a couple times a week to decrease the pounding on their joints, it's absolutely huge. And so really a lot of the movements that we do on land, we can do in the water. We just have to understand the properties of water in order to get what we want to get.
Yeah, it's always fascinating. Like I mean, obviously, it's so outside my scope of practice, but I'm always interested in, like, you know, how much you prescribe and how, you know, soon do you start integrating stuff back in the weight room and in the pool? Do you kind of ease them out of the pool and into the weight room at the same time, or you just kind of like shut off the pool stuff and then, like, all right, you're kind of ready to start doing some body weight stuff in regular gravity?
Yeah, it depends. You know, I very rarely do I go extremely like, you know, just one phase and then the other. You know, usually there's a lot of things going on at the same time. And so I will do stuff in the weight room at the same time as the pool, but a lot of times I'll introduce stuff in the pool. So for example, you know, a bench press type of a movement, even let's say, or, you know, some type of a rowing type movement. If they can do that in the water with resisted type movement and start to move it with some speed and move a little bit faster, you know, obviously free weights are completely different resistance from water, mm-hmm. but at least if they go through the movement, they can get used to the movement and they can say, okay, here's my range of motion. Here's what I'm, you know, I feel comfortable doing. Start to just introduce that motion. Start to introduce changes of speed in the water. You know, it's not scary in the water. They're not going to fall over in the water or do something crazy. So to introduce, you know, maybe we'll be doing slower movements on land and then be working on speed movements in the water and then eventually transfer those speed movements more towards land. You know, I kind of tend to use both at the same time. I guess that was a really long way of saying I use both at the same
time. No, makes sense. Leanne has a good question. Sue, you're obviously an awesome role model for women entering a male-dominated field. Even if your male colleagues were wonderful and supportive, did you still have to battle your own self-limiting thoughts about your capabilities, competency, or your right to be, quote, in the room. Do you have any advice or insights for other women in male-dominated fields who might have similar challenges? Thanks for being a badass.
Yeah. Aww, thank you. What was her name?
Leanne.
Thank you, Leanne. yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think 99% of what I experienced was really, really positive and really supportive. But yeah, you know, there were it wasn't easy, you know, definitely, as they say, the first one over the mountain doesn't usually make it. They're usually the first one to get shot. and so it was tough, you know, as far as sort of self-limiting thoughts. You know, it was hard to read things in the paper, you know, or read on social media. You know, social media makes people really brave. Mm. And unfortunately, sometimes it's hard to not let those things go to your head or, you know, kind of make you think like, man, you know, they're right. I do suck. I'm terrible. Why do I have this job? So, you know, it's, I think really important to not read some of those things. I know it's really difficult not to, but you know, to not let, you know, to not, people don't know what's going on. People don't know what's happening. And so it's really easy to judge from the outside. And so, I think, you know, to not let some of those outside voices that really have no clue what's going on get into your head. Cause I think at least for me, it was easy at the time to get into my head and kind of make me self doubt a little bit. But you know, at the end of the day, kind of pulled through that. You know, I think that, as far as advice goes, you know, I think it's just, you have to be strong enough, I think, to command respect, but we also have to be flexible, right? Like I always just take the approach, I'm in their world. I'm in their clubhouse. I'm in their locker room, mm-hmm. right? Like I don't expect 40 men to change because I'm around. I need to respect their space. I'm the one in their space. And so, you know, to be respectful, I never hung out in the locker room, you know, where they were showering or, you know, I'm not saying I never went in there. You go in there, you do what you need to do. You pass along whatever message you need to pass along and you get out, you respect their space. Just like they respected the training room space. They knew that's where I would be, you know, so they didn't walk in there naked. They'd walked in with a towel, you know, or whatever. And so I think it's just a matter of mutual space, mutual respect for each other's space. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for women to remember, you know, it's a lot easier for one person to sort of modify where they go than 40 people. And just really kind of respect that I think is important. You know, it's not always fair, right? And that's just the way it is. You know, there's times where I had to change in a janitor's closet. There's a lot of times I wasn't able to shower after the game because there was no place for me to shower. And I had to, you know, get dressed all sweaty and head back to the hotel and shower at the hotel. You know, and yeah, that stuff is aggravating, but it is what it is. You know, I think as new clubhouses are built, right, and ballparks are renovated or arenas are renovated, you know, they'll start making things more gender neutral or at least have options for women and men, you know. But a lot of these old arenas, they just don't have the facilities, you know, and you can't expect, you know, Wrigley Stadium to add a female bathroom just because there's, you know, two females, you know, hanging out. You know, those things take time. And I think that, you know, as women, we just need to have patience with some of those things. And, you know, just kind of roll with that kind of stuff. That stuff's easy, but hopefully I answered that question.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm coming from the opposite end, but it's kind of still blowing me away that it's 2015 and you're still having like the first female NFL referee in 2015. Right.
Yes. Yes. I just tweeted that story out. I mean, how great, you know,
it's about damn
but
time.
It's amazing, yeah. Right? Yeah, like you said, it's 2015, and it's just incredible. And we're just going to see things like this happening more and more. You know, the ball's been started, and I'm certainly not the one that started it. It started years ago, and just sort of the longer that ball keeps rolling, the more momentum it's going to pick up. And you know, hopefully, that next generation isn't going to, you know, they won't think twice about it.
Let's move on. We will. I was actually going to mention as well, like even looking at the Perform Better seminars, it's good to see that there's more female speakers, because I remember not even 5 years ago, there was like one female speaker. like the summits, and that's, and it's, you know, nothing to do with really perform better. It's just, you know, more that it's, I feel like they're, the female voices of the industry, they're getting stronger. They're getting out there more, and they're being louder, and people are, you know, listening more, which is, again, it's like something you would think in the this 2015, that you think this wouldn't be the case, but at least, like you said, it's, we're turning a corner at least.
Yeah, for sure.
This stuff. Let's go to a question from, this is a good question from Jason, since it was brought up a little bit earlier. Just your thoughts on PRI, and if it's shifted your thinking on the thoracic spine at all.
That's a good question. You know, I've taken a couple PRI courses, which I very much enjoyed. And I think that, you know, across the board, no matter what class you take, it always sort of shifts your thinking maybe one way or the other, or at least kind of adds in some different techniques and different things to sort of think about. And so PRI definitely did that. You know, it definitely got my mind, looking at things a little bit differently. It definitely got my mind, I'm going to say, thinking about respecting the asymmetries that people have, right? Like, yeah, we do have different, everyone's asymmetric. And so, you know, I think we constantly talk about symmetry, but, you know, really our liver's on our right side, our stomach's more on our left side, our, you know, we have asymmetries in our body. And I think, you know, studying some of the PRI stuff was really sort of the first time I was like, okay, yeah, I can accept some of these asymmetries. We are different from side to side. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that we want pathological orthopedic asymmetries, but it just kind of made me sort of accept and respect things in a little bit different way.
We had a question from Scotty. I guess you would love to hear your thoughts on trainers building trust with PTs and MDs for patients, and maybe even like vice versa.
Yeah, you know, I am a huge advocate for people spending time with each other. you know, I always say I am a better PT because of the strength coaches that I hung out with. And I become a better physical therapist and athletic trainer and clinician the more I hang out with strength coaches and fitness coaches, because bottom line, that's what our athletes need to return to, right? And if I don't understand what they need to return to, then how can I prepare them for that return to play? And so, you know, the more I hang out with those two professions, you know, fitness professionals and strength and conditioning and performance professionals, the more I learn, the more I improve my game as far as transitioning an athlete from rehab to performance, you know, and vice versa. I mean, I think that strength coaches and fitness coaches, you know, if you can just find one clinician, you know, PT and or athletic trainer who is open to that, you know, and open to wanting to exchange information and to pass people back and forth, you know, like fitness professionals don't want to deal with hurt people, mm-hmm. you know, and so to be able to use, you know, have a symbiotic relationship with a clinician and not to have that clinician steal that patient, but to really work collaboratively with a clinician, I think is huge. And so, you know, I think I always kind of use the mantra, seek to understand, you know, so if you go in to a PT clinic and hang out with a PT and vice versa, if a PT goes into any type of a gym space and hangs out with a strength coach, you know, ask questions, you know, that's not the time to show what you know. That's not the time to show how intelligent or how smart or how, you know, great you are. That's the time for you to seek to understand. That's the time for you to ask questions, ask, you know, why they're doing certain things, ask, just, you know, just really sort of take that time to seek to understand. And then I think people really appreciate that. And then they will seek to understand you back. And so, I've had good success with kind of approaching different professions and, professionals that way. And, you know, that would probably be the best advice that I could give.
Let's see. We got a two-parter from Steven. Please ask Sue about her involvement and thoughts on Brian Grasso's Mindset Performance Institute. How does she see it growing, impacting our industry? Also, could she comment on the general philosophy and conditioning approach she saw while with the Dodgers?
Yeah. Yeah, well, starting with the Mindset Performance Institute that Brian has started, you know, it's I'm on their advisory council and really fired up to be a part of it. I think that, you know, during that year for me in 2014, really gave me a lot of time to sort of look at things a different way, right? And everyone has different phases and seasons in their life. And I'm definitely in a different phase in my life. Like, I love work and I love what I do. And what I sort of learned over the last year is it doesn't necessarily define who I am, right? Like, those are two different things. And so the mindset that people are in at different times in their life, or even, you know, in different days, can just completely affect what is going on. And you know, and we see that all the time with our hurt athletes, you know, guys that are hurt. You know, if I hurt my hand and I couldn't work and I couldn't do manual therapy, I you know, what else am I going to do? Mm-hmm. And so at least with the level that I work at, you know, these guys are professional athletes. This is how they provide for their families. And so when they're hurt, you know, that's a scary thing. And so to be able to help them through that stuff physically is really a portion of what they're dealing with, right? They're dealing with family issues. They're dealing with those types of pressures. And so, you know, I think the mindset of where people are at and where you are at as a professional is absolutely huge and really an untapped area. You know, I think we get so focused on the physical because there is so much to focus on the physical that sometimes we skip over some of the mental stuff. And so, you know, that was a huge thing that I learned in my yoga training and definitely a huge reason that I'm a part of the Mindset Performance Institute, because I think that really that is our next untapped era, right? Is, you know, we've talked about nutrition, we've talked about biomechanics, we've talked about movement, you know, what we need to tap into the mind, we need to tap into where we are at mentally and how that affects our physical. So I just think this is the next area that we're going to really begin to study. So I'm excited to be on the forefront and support Brian in that and to learn more in that area myself.
Yeah, I gotta check that out. I've known, it sounds like a long time ago, I know Brian back in 2006 when he was doing like the IYCA stuff. So I haven't talked to him in a long time, but I gotta check back in with him because that sounds super interesting.
Yeah. It's I think it's, you know, it's headed in a great direction. Obviously it's just beginning, but yeah, I feel really strongly this is our next area of study that you're going to see a lot of people talking about in the near future.
And also, I guess he wanted to see any general comments on the philosophy and conditioning approach with the Dodgers.
Yeah, you know, obviously it changes and evolves. I haven't been there in a couple years. So, you know, Brandon McDaniel is their head strength coach there and is fantastic. He came over there with me, used to work with Athletes Performance at the time in our military division. And he was one of the people that came over with me to the Dodgers and, you know, was first in AAA and then moved up to the major leagues and is now the major league strength coach. And so he's done a great job as far as sort of switching some of the mindset stuff. You know, conditioning in baseball is tough. You know, it's 162 game season in 183 days, and that's not an easy thing to prepare for or to maintain. And so, you know, I think focusing a lot on good, efficient work. Mm-hmm. Right. And not like the last thing these guys need is just excess volume, right? Just to check a box that says, all right, they worked their upper body out twice a week. They worked out their lower body twice a week. Check, 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 check. Great. Done. You know, it's not just about that. It's about efficient work. You know, not just adding on volume. So Brandon's done a really good job. Obviously it's really hard to turn a ship. But he's heading that in a great direction, and I'm excited to see where he takes it next.
Awesome. Well, actually, not. I'm a Red Sox fan, so
you have to be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they would only meet in the World Series unless it's interleague stuff. But before we get into the last question, I want to first take a second to thank everyone that is supporting the show through Patreon at patreon.com/thefitcast. We've had a bunch of people jump on with the addition of the Agenda Free Fitcast, where I've recorded 9 of those so far. Some of them almost going an hour long. So those are pretty, it's a pretty decent addition in content, and we're getting close to that goal of doing one of those every single week. So if you want to jump on there, you can help out and support the show going on during the future, and we will be good to go. So that again is patreon.com/thefitcast. Thank you so much to everyone that's supporting the show. So this isn't fireworks at the end of the show. We're going to talk about stretching for a minute. All right. not the most exciting topic, but it's always interesting to kind of check in and see where we're at. And Travis has a question. He literally just said in stretching, where are we at? What's the consensus? Because I feel like still we're getting to the point where, like, every other year we're saying, no, stretching is bad. Stretching is good. Like, where are we at?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I just wrote that flexibility chapter in David Joyce's book, the High Performance Training Book, where I tried to summarize the research as best as I could. I mean, that was one of the most frustrating chapters for me to write because there's so much conflicting information out there that, you know, as a practitioner, it's like, well, what is it? You know, what do we want to do? And you can find a study that says yes for this and no for this, for just about everything. And so it can get frustrating. You know, we're almost drowning in a quantity of research, and yet we still don't quite know best practices of what to do. And so, you know, really at the end of the day from my lit review there is, you know, static stretching. I think over the years we've tossed it out the window as like this bad, awful thing. And really, you know, research has shown some really great benefits, like increase in maximal voluntary contractions, you know, increases just a lot of different benefits with static stretching. But when it's done over a long period of time at the end of the day or not before a performance. So I think static stretching, you know, for us to have our athletes do that at night or on off days or non-competitive days, you know, I think there's still value in that. Not right before they go perform, not right before they go to work out. But, you know, there's surprisingly some solid value in static stretching long term, even if there's some negative performance effects in the short term. So I think that's one thing. You know, I think the next horizon is really the fascial stuff, you know, and I was lucky enough to speak in Germany in February with Robert Schleip, and I actually have his book laying at my feet right now. You know, his book is called Fascia in Sport and Movement, and it's a fantastic book. I'm about 3/4 of the way through it. And, you know, really, how do we train fascia? How does fascia affect flexibility? How does it affect our range of motion? You know, and how does it even store energy and possibly contribute to our power outputs? You know, I think the fascia stuff is really not an untapped area, but it's a new area that people are exploring. So if you can get that book, Robert Schleip, that's entitled Fascia, great read, great book to pick up. And so, you know, we don't exactly know like what the best way right now is to stretch fascia. But yeah, definitely the dynamic movement type stuff, pre-participation, pre-game, pre-practice, that's definitely good still. But you know, does stretching decrease injuries? You know, no, not necessarily, not that we know right now. You know, does it improve performance? Yeah, static stretching at the end of the day, long term, yeah, it has shown to improve some performance measures. But you know, does it reduce our injury potential? We don't know that yet. So there is a lot of stuff on stretching that we don't know. It's frustrating, but hopefully, I summarized the research in that book chapter well, and can at least provide some clarity as far as, you know, when to do stuff and why.
Cool. You can grab that on Amazon, but it's out of stock right now. So hopefully they're going to get some more copies. Looks like people are buying the crap out of that book.
Yeah, it's great. They did a great job, you know, just putting people together and authors together. It's a great read.
So again, like I mentioned before, suefalsoni.com is where you want to go. That's like the hub for Sue.
That's the hub.
All right. So you can also, like I said, you can check out systematic dry needling information on there. You can get all the dates of where she's going to be at. You can also check out consulting. And are you blogging? You got the blog going?
I am. I'm blogging. I need to get on a regular blogging schedule. But yes, I am blogging, and it's all up on there as well.
Awesome. Well, Sue, anything else that people should know about? Like we said, the shoulder DVD is going to be coming out in like 3 weeks. So you want to make sure you keep an eye on Target Publishing. That's Larry Draper's site where all that stuff's going to be coming out. And also you're on Twitter. If people want to follow you on there, is it just at Sue Falsone?
Yep. At Sue Falsone. That's it.
Awesome. Well, that is going to do it for this episode. You can, like I said, check all that stuff out in the show notes if you are in the car. And Sue, I guess I'll see you in like, I don't know, like, what is it? Is it March? What is it, April? So what, April? I don't know. April. What? Like 3 months?
Yeah. Yeah, about 3 months. That'll be great.
And it won't be, there probably won't be snow in Massachusetts.
That's right. But whatever. Hopefully by August there won't be snow in Massachusetts. I know it doesn't feel that way right now, but
someday there will be no more snow. All right, thank you, Sue, and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you for having me on again, Kevin. Always great to talk. I'm in the fast lane. Is done. It's our time for having fun. I'm gonna